Welcome back, everybody. Eric Prostyovsky, your tireless host on GovCon Different. And all of you know that listen to this show that AI and automation is such a hot topic. If you look at the Hollywood strikes right now, there are people worried and creative people, brilliant people, that they may lose their jobs. It is estimated that 300 million people globally, clerical, creative, customer service, that those jobs are going away. And the American citizen is losing faith that government can help. And it's not just me saying that. Gallup will tell you that 3/5 of Americans have lost trust in the American government. So the question becomes, how can we navigate these challenging issues? And what creative policies can be developed to really tackle them head on? So thrilled today to be talking to Melissa Flagg and Dewey Murdoch. Melissa is the founder of Flagg Consulting, and she's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research in the Obama administration. Dewey is the Executive Director of the Center for Security and Emerging Technology. And they both have a lot to say on this topic, and they've written a policy playbook. We're gonna talk to them about this and this topic. But before we do any of that, Melissa, Dewey, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So if you would, and Dewey, I'll start with you. Just in a nutshell, what is this policy playbook? I'd like to just talk a little bit about that, establish that.
Yeah, so part of what it is actually comes from where it began. I was working for the federal government. I was working in various places within the Department of Defense and eventually in the Department of Homeland Security and the intelligence community. And I realized that, you know, there were so many parts of government that were operating that it was super easy to lose perspective and forget what other agencies and organizations and departments were actually doing, what their authorities were, and how they could actually accomplish our mission, which was more than just, you know, defense or intelligence or homeland security. It was really for the benefit and acting in the interest of our representative democracy. So I started, going on about 2011, started accumulating what are the power levers? What are the things that people can use? And how can these be used in concert? And that's really where in the last few years, and talking with Melissa, we've worked together for many years. And Jack Corrigan, who's also been helped write this paper. And we were like, wait, it's so easy as a particular agency to get fixated. We need this particular action to take place. We need export controls to stop the Chinese from getting ahead of us. We need to protect people from facial recognition so that people don't get thrown in jail or arrested inappropriately. It's easy to get fixated on those particular concepts and forget how if we ban all facial recognition, how does that actually work? What does that impact elsewhere? Does it make something that we really care about now much more difficult to do? What if we, have a program that works very hard at protecting all people from AI so well so that nothing ever gets released? Wait, we've just slowed down innovation. And so this is really what became really clear to me is we need to, when we're either a citizen and we're thinking about what needs to be done, or whether you're a representative or you're part of an executive branch, you need to understand what is our action actually doing? What are we trying to get at? Are we trying to innovate? Are we trying to slow down our competitor? Are we trying to make our people safe? And how does the action that I'm thinking going to play with all the other actions that could be taken and really avoid throwing two levers that perfectly work against each other? And now you've spent a lot of money, you've spent a lot of time, you've spent a lot of political capital. And to the American people, you've done zero because you've just canceled out both things. Yeah. And that's the fear which I'm worried about, and I'm seeing little bits of it. So we decided, hey, let's actually write this down. It's worth saying, and it's worth for us to think about both as policymakers, executive branch, and also as a citizen of the United States.
I love the thinking about it systematically, thinking about the complexities and the interdependencies in a world right now where, let's be honest, sometimes the loudest voice feels that it can just steamroll instead of stepping back. So I really appreciate that perspective. Melissa, your thoughts on this report? And I think that Dewey certainly did a great job of summing it up, but love to get your perspective as well.
Yeah, I was so excited when Dewey and I started talking about this, because I reflect back to a point where, okay, I'm a political appointee. I'd been a civilian for years. I left, I came back, and now I'm supposed to be in charge of sort of research at the Department of Defense, of doing oversight of that, of understanding how fast we're moving. Are we delivering the right things to the field? But also, are we protecting against the adversary? Are we understanding the emerging threats and capabilities on the horizon? Trying to balance all of these things, and to also work within a political context that is a reality, right? And what I found often in those moments is there was no framework within which to really lay out these things and to really act like the systems engineers that I was working with at the Department of Defense, right? We often believe in science when it's applied to widgets, but we very rarely apply those same approaches and methods and thought frameworks back to these sort of less technical problems. So for me, it was such an interesting thing to explore the ability to allow people to develop a trade space, right? To be able to sit on the Hill as a young staffer who really cares about their job and to say, I have this person yelling in my ear, industry needs unfettered access to people and money and technology so that we can move fast. And somebody yelling in my other ear, China is stealing from us and eating our lunch, and we have to slow all of this down. And to have somebody else yelling, we're really hurting marginalized communities and building bias into our models because we're not thinking really about the way we're building AI. And somebody else saying, but speed is the most important thing. And as a policymaker and as a congressional staffer, how do you begin to balance these things? And so a framework for thinking and talking about it in a way that is apolitical is so appealing to me.
You know, oh, it's fascinating. And as you're talking, we stream TV in my family, and a lot of families do. And between the shows and even during, there is so often different commercials that cover all of the different things. It could be pharmaceutical, it could be AI, it could be energy. And they are exactly leaning in. We must do this and we must move forward. So what I'd love to do today is, and I like this idea of looking at the trade space on top of the Hill. And I'd like to look at a specific application within this trade space. There was an article out in the New York Times last week, and it was called Training My Replacement: Inside a Call Center Worker's Battle with AI. And it was really the story of a young woman, Miss Yolanda Sherrod, that lives in Mississippi, and she's a call center worker for AT&T. And like millions of others, she senses that her job may go away. And when she asks her leadership, hey, I see all this AI that's been implemented, how's that going to affect our job? She's getting answers like, oh, the human being will never be replaced. And this is just meant, of course, to add an additional layer of customer service. Yet she's very bright. And she says, I'm not sleeping well at night. So what I'd love to do is look at the playbook and the policy levers, but through the perspective, that trade space of somebody like Yolanda, where we really say, okay, in this world. And the first thing that I would like to ask both of you is, what went wrong? Why are Yolanda and so many other Americans facing hopelessness, fear, especially when we look at AI and autonomous technologies? Dewey, I'll start with you.
So I appreciate that. I'm really looking forward to Melissa's answer on this too. Just stepping back, a million things went wrong. It's hard to say that, you know, well, because the way the U.S. government works is you've got local, you've got a lot of state, and you have federal level authorities. You've got private sector the U.S., rightfully so, really respects the private sector. We don't try to like nationalize everything so that we have control over all aspects, because that the centralized command economy just doesn't work well for so many reasons. So we have a situation right now where technology, and it's done it before. It happened with the Luddites, with the weavers in the UK. And that's not minimizing this point at all. Clearly not minimizing. So we've had this experience happen. And actually, in some ways, we've been anesthetized to this reality of like, oh, well, another group of people are losing their jobs. Oh, well. So there's part of it. What went wrong is we see it happen so much. We don't know what to do. So we just kind of like say, oh, well, I guess they'll have to figure that out. Good luck, Ilana. Yeah. And I wish you well, which is really a terrible angle, especially when this is going to impact real people's lives in quantity. The numbers you gave are significant. Mm-hmm. So at the risk of just going on just a little bit more, I want to make sure Melissa can jump in here. I think we have to recognize that there's a whole bunch of actors, and one of the main points of this paper is it's so easy as the Department of X to get fixated on my little levers and say, well, it really doesn't directly impact call centers, so I'm off the hook. I don't have anything to say on this. And I think we have to, especially as technology is increasing in speed, we have to stop and say, wait, people are what matter here. We have to think about what are the impacts that my tax credit or my export control change or my sanction or my changing of loan rules or changing of what is regulated and how, you know, are the expense of an employee versus expensive technology. I mean, that's actually a big factor, because if you make technology so much cheaper than a person, then you're creating an incentive system to let go of people and make do with less of them. Mm-hmm. So there are so many factors, and what I would like to see, and that's what we're kind of calling for, is like, when you are trying to accomplish something, like make sure that our population, and not just our population, but our states and our counties and our cities, have adequate employment and meaningful employment, things that, you know, really are useful, and jobs that people can throw themselves into with passion. We have to stop and not get this out of jail free card of like, well, I actually don't have any direct impact on her, therefore it doesn't matter. Even though my policy options or the things that I'm proposing in front of Congress or the executive branch is doing an executive order is directly impacting this.
You know, when you're talking about that, and we were just talking about all these commercials that I'm inundated with, none of them talk about, on page 11 of your report, there's this Venn diagram and it talks about training and education and labor and digital infrastructure regulations. Some of those checks and balances, those inherent things we must be thinking of. And I will tell you, most people that I talk to feel, wow, we've been very flat-footed on this, that these things are coming and now we're starting to react. All kinds of senators are talking about it openly. So, Melissa, I'd love to hear from you the same question that I asked Dewey, which is really, what went wrong, right? I mean, why is Yolanda and so many other people in this boat right now and feeling kind of hopeless?
So, I mean, I agree with everything Dewey said. I would add on to that, that I think that, so in many ways, we're repeating a past. Manufacturing jobs went away to automation. Oh, well, go get retrained. What I think is really interesting about this moment that does, in fact, differentiate us a little bit is two things. One, for the first time, the people who are starting to get uncomfortable aren't just Yolandas, right? Mm-hmm. They're people who believe that they have high-skilled jobs that they paid $150,000 to go to college for. They're lawyers, they're accountants, right? They're script writers. They are people that believed that they invested in a high-skill job and would never be automated, right?
Yeah.
So this is a moment that's uncomfortable for people in a new way, and they don't want to seem classist, right? When it was factory workers, they're like, just go learn to code. When it's a journalist, he's like, well, you can't tell me to just go learn to code. That's crazy, right? So there's a little bit of this going on, which is interesting. And I think makes it difficult to have really good conversations at the policy level, because some of those people are worried about their jobs going away as well, right? The second thing that I think is really unique in this moment is speed. Dewey and I have talked about this a lot. It's really the one like aspect of the impetus of why we wanted to write this paper now. Government is meant to be slow, and technology is increasing at a pace that that kind of path of slow, deliberate process does not work at the pace of the technology itself. And so this idea that you can just change the entire environment, that you can make the people making the policies very uncomfortable, right? Make them worry about the livelihood of their own kids and expect them in an unbiased way to write policies about technology they cannot possibly understand, right? And the private sector is buying commercial spots. The private sector is out there advocating for the one lever it holds. Don't regulate. Don't pull your levers. Leave us alone. The lever they pull over and over again is unfettered ability to do whatever we want. And it's not a bad lever sometimes, but it needs to be in balance with some of these other levers, right? I would argue also, there's one last thing that I just want to throw out. I truly believe that somehow the discourse, because I believe that this helps industry, the discourse has become, well, the technology's coming, either we innovate and we lead, or we lose. And I put lose in air quotes because I don't exactly know what we're losing. But everyone in the US seems to believe if we aren't number one, we lost something, and that's bad. Okay, well, at the end of the day, there is this reality that that's a false narrative that has been constructed for us and that somehow we've all bought into. There are 100 other narratives that we could generate that really focus on the co-creation of AI with the people who are involved in the workforce, with the very people we want to create thriving lives for, right? Our citizenry. And this idea that instead it's either Yolanda loses her job and a relatively crappy AI takes over, right? Because if I'm calling customer service, it's because it's not a common problem. It's an uncommon problem, or I'd be on the app fixing it without having to talk to a human. I'm calling a human because I have an uncommon problem. And so the intersection of a human and that AI can potentially be so much more powerful. But we decide that because industry wants to do away with the most expensive thing, the human, that everybody else will just have to suck up whatever that leads us to, whatever future that leads us to, as if we have no agency as human beings to choose a different path. And so I think part of the way we got here is by allowing a false narrative to be constructed for us. And I hope that this policy construct, defining a trade space that lets people push back and say, well, why are you only focused on these two levers? Why are you only talking about this little portion of the problem? What about these other 12 things? It really can empower people to ask better questions and to demand a better narrative.
Fascinating perspective from both of you. And when I think about this, and I love the idea of not just thinking about Yolanda in a call center, I've interacted with ChatGPT lately. And as I told the two of you, it blew me away. I would ask it all kinds of questions on what I do, communication coaching, video production. Then I would say, tell me a story. Within microseconds, it's churning it out to where not only, and I'm worried for my daughter, Abby, she's 20, my son, Ryan's 21, but I start saying, huh, the work that Cliff and I do, you could automate. Would it be as good? We'd like to think not, but it puts you in the shoes of that person. It's not anymore an abstract problem, right? And so I think that's so key when we talk about these things and this notion of a false narrative. Well, wait a second, let's put ourselves in the shoes because it's going to affect us as well. And so what I'd love to do is actually talk about maybe the right policy narrative. So if somebody like Yolanda is saying, okay, that's great, and all of you are clearly very intelligent and you've thought about this, how does that help me? What would we tell her as far as how government institutions could work together to solve this problem, and that we could look at her with a straight face, that we're not just sent out there by some organization to say, be strong, that we have something to say? Dewey, I'd love to get your thoughts first on using the levers to solve this problem.
Yeah. So I will, one will be right on your question, and one is going to be just slightly orthogonal to it. But first of all, just going back to an illustration, just to make this concrete. So when any government decides how to distribute the cost of governance, government, protection of its people, all the things that people believe the governments do, they have to decide how they're going to distribute that cost. So income tax is an example of a type of cost that is selected because it made a lot of sense after World War II or in the midst of that to say, okay, we've got people, people are working, people are the primary drivers of our innovation. We need to use that. Now, before that, you know, trade duties and other things were the big drivers. Mm-hmm. Now, as we're getting to a place where technology, so there's a lot of hidden costs in these large language models. There's greenhouse, there's impact on our environment by huge compute. There's impact that is right now, like, for example, with semiconductor industries, we're doing a huge amount of shipping. And yes, that's a cost, but also that shipping is possible because the oceans are relatively safe. So we've got now a hidden cost of a Navy baked into all of this. And a company saying, oh, well, we don't have, you know, this is the cheapest, is essentially acknowledging a bunch of latent costs that now that they're getting for free. And I'm not trying to say we tax, you know, every, anyway, the point is we need to acknowledge these. So when we come now to the power levers that we have available to us, there are new levers that are like, okay, how does the non-human language generating system work into this ecosystem? Does the government need to think about that, be local or any federal organization, need to start thinking about taxing a different way? But the thing is, this isn't part of the discussion right now. Oh, no, well, I'm not saying that no one's had this idea before. I'm not that bright. Other people have had this idea. But the point is, you only see that when you look at that Venn diagram and you're like, oh, wait, there's something in this diagram of like, oh, that's right, I need to include that, and I've forgotten it. And it's actually the human brain. It's super easy to forget because power levers fall out of fashion, and regulation of a certain type of rules suddenly become very popular in certain areas, and that's all the ones people can think about, and you forget. Oh, wait, we have this whole thing of, you know, antitrust has come up as, you know, in some of these things, but like, you know, hubs, you know, actually trying to create innovation hubs and let me connect this now to the call center of figuring out humans, how humans and machines can actually up the quality rather than just trying to save a buck. Maybe we can and I'm going to borrow a term from Melissa in our conversation, you know, call center 4.0. I hope you don't mind me using that for you. Let's actually bring a hub together and actually innovate in a way that now Yolanda has a voice to actually say what the future looks like. And actually might radically change how me as a person who's trying to make it, I was on a call for an hour with AT&T a little while ago. I got bumped to level one, then to level two, and everyone's like, well, I don't know how to solve your problem. And it was so frustrating. And maybe there was a way of innovating now with this AI tool. Maybe level one can actually handle level two problems. And maybe there's ways of innovating. I'm not a call center person, so Yolanda really is the person I would want to talk to here to help craft this. And I think an innovation hub now provides an opportunity. Now, the orthogonal thing I want to mention I just finished, out of sheer passion and frustration, writing a blog post where I was trying to get at the point of human machine teaming. So many people are like, AI is going to destroy my job. And the reality is, all the AI I've know of that will happen in the next 10 years is going to require human agency to be part of that. So this view of the robot coming for my job, at least in the next 10 years, I would go on record to say, that's probably not what we're talking about. We've got a human who is teaming with a machine. And the question is, are we actually designing that system to operate beautifully together, where trust is appropriately calibrated? When you ask it a question, you know what kind of answer it's going to give you, and you actually learn to work much more effectively together. And to me, this kind of design parameters is missing from some of our discussions of building trust in this new era of human machine teaming. And I'm extremely excited about this, because I've already seen it where I'm using AI tools to compensate for my weaknesses. And I've learned how to trust it. So I don't ask it things I know it can't do, but it makes me much faster in certain tasks.
Yeah. And Melissa, before I jump to you, where can people find that blog post? Because I love the thinking in that. Let's do a plug for that right now, Dewey. What's the title of it? Where can they find it?
Yeah. So Building Trust in AI, A New Era of Human Machine Teaming. It's written by me. It's on CSET.georgetown.edu's site. You can just search for CSET Dewey Murdoch and you'll find my all the stuff I've written.
Okay, beautiful. And I'll check that out as well. One of the reasons we do this show is to get this understanding out there. And I think about during COVID, Melissa, a lot of people started to wake up, myself included, and say, wow, we've had this market-driven economy and we've not stepped back to think about, all the medications I get, tons of what's required is coming from China. Some of the supply chain issues, because what was profitable, that was what was workable. Let's do that. Instead of what I hear in this conversation, this systematic human-centered approach that says, no, wait a second, what makes sense? Of course, things need to be profitable. But how can we best develop cultures, governance, policies that drive that make sense, whether we talk about somebody like you land at the call center or anybody else? So, Melissa, I'd love to get your perspective on how we can use the levers as a government to effectively assure a lot of people that are very afraid.
For me, I think what's interesting is many levers can be positive or negative in a place, depending on what your position is and how you use the lever, right? So if I think about money, I think about funding as a lever, I can think about government using that to create security systems to keep people from coming in, to try to secure our sort of technology base, which may slow innovation, or the government can use funding to fund research and speed our innovation, right? So we can't assign sort of good and bad and kind of moralistic approaches to the levers. I think the key is to look at these levers and say, okay, I've got workforce, I've got training and education, I've got regional hubs as an enabler to think through how different things like money and tax credits and workforce are different in each location. And then I have the incentives of every actor in that space, right? So I can think about, as a call center, can I put together a regional activity that really helps us figure out how to provide better training to team with AI so that the current workforce does, in fact, lean into this wave and they keep their jobs longer? Can I create brainstorming spaces that maybe are funded by the federal government or are funded by local activities, right? And we're bringing industry researchers in and we're bringing actual people who man call centers and other activities in to talk about what does better quality look like, right? How do we break our minds out of what Dewey mentioned, which is we just keep doing the bare minimum. And how do we rethink the incentives that we've allowed to be put in place across the board to think about where they actually negatively impact the thriving of our citizens. So where we have placed incentives in the system that say, extract from labor and provide it to a group of people who didn't provide the rewards of that to a group of people who had no sort of part in actually building the thing that you sold, right? Building the revenue that you're now sharing out. We do have to think about, okay, well, that's subsidized by, say, Walmart, for instance, which has a huge percentage of its employees on food stamps. Mm-hmm. They're being subsidized by a lever of power of the United States federal government in order to allow industry to do business in a specific way. So we've created sort of weird incentives in the system. Mm-hmm. So if we could find a way for industry to be more incentivized by improving quality and new products and rethinking how they can market that and actually win market space through improved quality, that's not built on the back of getting rid of people doing the cheapest mm-hmm. bare minimum thing possible, then that really benefits, I think, the entire nation. And if we can do this also at regional and local levels, you'll get so much more creativity, you'll get so much more diversity in the approaches, and a representative government like ours really sees the direct benefit in their place. Each representative that then goes to the Hill has to argue against their own people actively. So it's so important to bring these conversations all the way down to the local level and show people, we want you to be creative with us and let's dream across this entire space. Let's talk about all the incentives, every lever. Let's talk about the power you do or do not have. Let's let you meet the people that hold that lever, yeah. right? Yeah. I just like, it's really hard to feel empowered when you don't know how something works. And I feel like part of what Dewey and I are trying to do is pull back the curtain and let's all see the Wizard of Oz behind the little curtain and realize, like, you can all understand this. We need to educate Congress. We need to educate leadership at DOD, and we need to educate call center workers. Like, we're trying to find a framework that makes this less opaque.
As we talk about this, and Melissa, you and I talked about this once before, quite a while back, Amazon knows my family, I think, better than we do. I think on any given day, there's different products coming into the house, and they know us via data analytics. And as I'm listening, Dewey, to both of you, you and Melissa, I'm hearing this notion of regional, local approaches, yet it strikes me that for the levers to really be optimized, we need better information. We need better data so that policymakers, from that senator to that staffer, can have, just like a company may, a business dashboard that would tell me, huh, in Missouri right now, somebody just bought 30, 35 acres. What are they doing with that? Up in Montana, so that we're not doing these widespread policies that, one, they may only be driven by one or two levers, but they don't represent the problems on the ground. So I think the perspective is so fascinating. Yeah, please, Melissa.
I want to jump in because you're like the best straight man for Dewey because you've just hit Dewey's like deep passion. But I just want to throw out really quickly that I think it's so important to understand what's going on, right? But to also give people agency within that understanding to say, you want to know about me, but I am also important. I am not an extractive resource. So if you are going to mine value from me, I should be able to expect, right, some value back from that. I don't want to be a latent cost, as Dewey described, right? I don't want to allow this system to grow around me and for me to be the thing that is being dug out of the mine. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really important as we go down this path, because I don't think I could agree with you more. I mean, it's so important, but it's also really important to remember that, again, we're building new levers. We're building new processes. And we have to think about the unintended consequences as we do. Mm-hmm.
And I love that notion. I never thought about it. My grandfather was a coal miner in West Central Pennsylvania. I never thought of it. I'm the resource now that is being mined. And Dewey, would love to get your thoughts on this particular topic as
well. Yeah, so I'm holding myself back, because there's something you mentioned that is I'd really like to get to about what we can do about this. Uh-huh. But let me just step one. I'm going to take a kind of a off the superhighway just for a second. Trust is essential. Right now, you mentioned it, the Pew research about the loss of trust in federal government. There's a strong and I think rational belief that, wait, well, I can't trust those folks in DC. They don't care about, I'm from rural Michigan. And you would ask me then and you'd ask me now, does the federal government care about what's happening in rural Michigan? And I would say, no. Yeah. We had a pretty good congressperson that I really liked that seemed to care about us, but it's not clear that people really care. And I wouldn't want to cede everything to the federal government because I think we would just get washed out. So now what do we do with this trust? And I think there's another, before I get to what do we do about this, there's one other reason for trust. So I was recently helping my mom apply for a federal program. I had done all the research about the criteria. She clearly met the criteria. I applied and she got denied. And I'm like, what? That was just such a gut kick because she really needed this. And I had done the research. I'd looked at all the distributions of like what kind of criteria. I mean, this is what I love to do. So I looked at it and I'm just like, what in the world? So my confidence in government just dropped because I know I'm eligible, or now my mom is eligible in this case. And I did not get that. And the reason they gave was such a bureaucratic, like, you applied once before and we denied you before, therefore you're not eligible to apply again. And you're like, but it's been years and my mom's in a different financial state now. And so I think it's really important that for us Americans to actually have confidence, we have to have belief that it's actually working.
Yes.
So, and I think it's really important that and public services, you know, welfare is one of them, you know, Medicaid, Medicare programs, obviously those are run by states, even though they're federally funded. And there's a big distribution of a change about how different states implement them.
Complicated, yes.
But I think, yeah, it is. And I've heard research that said that people who have seen themselves nonsensically get rejected from things vote less. And I can't put my finger on it right now, but I'm just kind of remembering that. If that kind of fact is true, then what we're doing is when our services don't work, we're actually demoralizing and actually removing people from public service. So there's the, from engaging in public and civic service, civic duty, whatever it is. So I think there's that we have to effectively use. And then the second thing is we talk about data. Do we want a big data lake with every single citizen's transaction and breath in and breath out recorded so that we can increase efficiency? I would argue by all means, no. That's a cybersecurity risk. People could hack that and take me to the cleaners all day long. I'm not sure I trust the government enough to have that data. And so I think there is some very important things to work out. I've got a few ideas about it, but we can't just say pour all data into the central vat and the world will be a better place. In fact, I would argue it might not be. So it's a little bit more complex by that.
And I want to get to the what we can do. And, you know, a friend of mine, Bill, he writes his representatives and his senators. And sometimes he'll even reach out to another senator, another state, but they're on a particular committee. They're the head of the committee. He gets form letters back from everybody. It's very deflating. He's very thoughtful. He's very well read. And he cares about issues like we're talking about, whether it's education, training. And it's back to what you said, demoralizing. So Dewey, I'll start with you and then we'll go over to Melissa. But what should we do about that?
Yeah. So there's no easy button here. It's not like we can say, simple. I think we have to step back and recognize that each of these policy actions fights and has intention with all of that. I think this framework piece is, if you accept that that's true, and I know of no one who argues that's true, not true, then What you need is whenever a policy lever is implemented, you have to actually see if it's working. There's an interesting story with the U.S. satellite industry in the 80s. A well-meaning congressional group said, oh, China might catch up with us in satellites. They'd recently launched the satellite, I think. And they're like, oh, we need to make sure that none of our intellectual property gets into the hands of the Chinese because they'll use it for bad. And so what they did is, and it made sense. I'm not criticizing them for thinking. Let's say we're just going to make it illegal for anything to be sold to the Chinese. So what happened is, in a matter of a few years, the U.S. went from like an 86 or somewhere around 90% market share in satellite technology to like a 30-something percent. So they basically killed the satellite industry in the U.S. It turns out Japan and European Union stood up these export control-free technology, and now everyone bought that, because why in the world would they want to buy something that had shackles on it? So if, when they had passed that well-meaning law, if they had baked into it, we're going to actually fund the evaluation of whether this core premise is actually holding and whether something is changing, it wouldn't have been that hard. But it's super easy to look away for a small group of lawmakers who have, you know, another action. The Iran-Contra affair is up and we need to deal with that. And there's no way to like check yourself and say that assumption is wrong. We need to stop this. And I think this is it's not going to cost that much more. It's just like when you put your cake in the oven, you need to have a glass and you need to have temperature and you need to have someone watching it to make sure your cake doesn't burn or fall or whatever. And I mean, this is pretty natural. And I think right now, when people put the legislation cake in the oven, they put it in a lead box and no one knows what happened to it. And they're like, is the cake edible? I was hoping to eat that cake, but I don't know. And a lot of people are, you know, were promised the cake and they get this charred mass eventually ejected from the oven. And I don't know. I think that is a core premise. I think especially when you're accelerating the rate of innovation, like before, you know, unfortunately, the U.S. has made many errors in the years. The courts have corrected many of them, and it's often taken 50 years or more, in some cases way longer, to correct. And I'm not saying that's acceptable, but when you're accelerating, 50 years is, wow, that's many lifetimes of technology. Who knows where we'll be in 50 years for the courts to correct it. So I think we have to build in a check and balance system that is appropriate for today's era. Anyway, I want to make sure we can keep talking about it, because this is super exciting.
It's fascinating. And that satellite story crystallizes the unintended consequences and effects of policy if all of the levers aren't thought through and you're not monitoring, right? And Melissa, I think about, and you mentioned in the beginning, government inherently is meant to move slower to do the checks and balances. Yet I was working with a client the other day, and I think he told me that YouTube alone, within a minute, 500 hours of new video is uploaded. We are moving at warp speed, and by the day it is going faster. So how do we monitor? How do we build on this notion of monitoring, continuous feedback loop, when we're at plaid speed, if anybody gets that reference? Melissa, I'll ask you that.
I mean, Dewey actually has a great proposal, and so I am in violent agreement with, as only I can be. So I'm going to leave that for him to say, but I am going to also just, I think, double down a little bit on this idea of speed and the need for something fundamentally new. We used to use the media as a way of questioning the government, right? Of checking, of forcing a little bit of transparency in places where the internal checks and balances of the three branches didn't really work, right? And I think that, again, speed and volume, I mean, you mentioned the YouTube videos. It's not just in social media. It's also in science. The number of publications that are being published every year is doubling like every 7 years, right? So we have this exponential increase in quote unquote knowledge that is so voluminous at some point that literally no one can consume it. So we don't even know what we know anymore, right? We don't know what we know on YouTube. We don't know what we know in science. And honestly, I don't think that the media has really been able to adapt to this new environment. They're trying so hard to keep up to being first that sometimes that sort of deep quality that they had to really question and expose some of these challenges as the sort of another check and balance isn't working in the same way that it used to. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that all journalism is bad. We desperately need it, but I think we do need something additional. I would also just say that we have to remember that it's not just about, should I use this lever and I use this feedback mechanism in order to know if it was good or bad? It's that the only tool we have right now are like sunset clauses, right? So we pass 9/11 happens, we pass the Patriot Act way too quickly because everybody needs to feel like we're doing something. We bake in a sunset clause, but no feedback mechanisms. We don't do the hard work of developing metrics. We don't pay anyone to actually monitor the 1,000 pages of the Patriot Act and every little thing that was baked in, every new authority that was baked in, right? We get 10 years down the road and we say, re-sign it. Well, how do I know what it did, right? So the sunset clause is like, it's a nod to, we sort of know that we need to check on these things, but we don't do the work up front so that we can check on them when we get to the sunset. Then one other thing is, most levers, when you pull them, they can be good for a while and then they can become bad. Right. And so much of this is about balance. It's like if you're driving your car and you're going down a straight road and you're just kind of cruising along, you don't really need the brake, right? You're on the interstate. And then someone pulls out in front of you and you need this other lever of power. You need to hit the brake. And right now we think, oh, the gas is what I need. We put the gas on and then we lock it away. And we don't realize that at some point we need to pull the gas back and apply the brake. We need to apply a little more security and pull back on the openness. We need to push back on the openness and pull back on the security. We need to think about balance. We need to care about the profit of industry, but we also need to care about the ability of workers to actually benefit from the labor that they provide, right? Yeah. They need to earn a living wage. And we have to think about these levers as transient, as changing, and as interdependent. And it is impossible for a person to predict where that will end and how that will need to change if you do not bake metrics and data collection, and actually someone who's funded to do that into the system.
You know, there's so much of that that resonates with me. When you talk about the Patriot Act, at the time, what feels good? And I was in the DC area when that happened. I was at CIA. Everybody was saying, and it was a total feeling, we've got to do something about this. But to your point, a few years later, had we all really thought about the incredible delicacy of what we were messing with in the Patriot Act. And we start talking about FISA court and all of those different things that we have seen play out. And then when I think about AI, even that one, we should have had those feedback loops, but AI, which may change weekly, and back to when we're thinking about people like Yolanda at that call center. So Dewey, Melissa could not have teed it up better for the proposal. So I'd love to hear your proposal on how do we actually at pace, at scale, be able to monitor some of this legislation?
Great. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say one thing about media, one thing about my story, which actually connects directly with this, and then some of the ideas. So media is trying to keep itself alive right now. It's hard to make money like it used to be in newspapers. Who under 30 actually watches television nowadays? I don't know. There's a lot of dynamic changes going on, so it's hard for media to actually have enough money. The other thing that is a reality is, and this has really lost people's trust in it, is you can report a protest in Austin, Texas. You can do it from a wide angle and make the crowd look tiny. You can come up close and make it look like there's a huge number of people here. You can write, you can choose not to report the protest at all, and now it's a nothing and nothing happened. And so that editorial selection of what topics, because and media can't cover everything, so I'm not trying to say it's all malicious, but it lowers my trust because I was at that protest. I saw a reporter there, and there was no report on it. Did that mean the editor buried it? Because I was really upset about that topic. And or it's, you know, a tiny, insignificant group of angry people said, and well, that was super minimizing. We had 150 people there. And then another one says, oh, there was this large group of protesters and there was 30 people there. It just happened to be. Anyway, sorry. The reason I'm mentioning this is the lack of systematic, and right now with the lack of funding, there's no way for, you know, even Jeff Bezos to have the New York Times be fully systematic. However, I think there is something here that we need to do. So my story, why did I get into the Center for Security and Emerging Technology? I was working for the Department of Defense. I worked for the intelligence community. I worked for the DHS. I worked for the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative in trying to cure all diseases. And what I have seen in my walk is people make really good decisions, better decisions at least, when you give them real information they can act on. And if it's actually, and it takes years sometimes to bake that information, or I'm sorry, getting into the cake again, but like to cook that up and make it so it's actually usable. It does, you can't just snap your fingers and say, should we renew the Patriot Act or not? Go. It takes, you know, many years to pull that data together. And so I've spent my entire career trying to advocate for this kind of analytic and data collection capability, appropriately managing trusts. You know, we're not trying to violate prep, but get the necessary information to inform real decisions. Because if you just try to collect all data for everything, then you get all violating of all sorts of principles of privacy. But if you know what you're actually trying to do, you understand the core parts of government that you're actually trying to evaluate and know, you can actually tailor your data collection to something that is not invasive. Anyway, so I've spent my entire life trying to help people make better decisions. And it is so empowering to the person you're helping when you can do that. So colored from that perspective, I really believe the U.S. government needs something different. We need, so we've heard about the fourth estate. It's, you know, it's the fourth branch of government, you know, the media, and they need to serve. What if we actually took this seriously and look for systematic monitoring outside of the government, because you really want to make sure that it doesn't, in today's world, we don't really trust America. We need to, our government needs to earn its trust back. And now you've got a systematic media-like, but not chasing my ad revenue type approach that is actually acting in the public interest, being able to systematically measure, going back to that Patriot Act example, and doing the hard work to pull the data together to say, this is a problem. This isn't actually operating like we think. Or the satellite industry, we're killing companies left and right. And we've got a systematic check and balance that can monitor and can be part of our civic discourse. And allows it's not an organization that tries to remove human agency. It actually says, look, citizens of the United States, this is your information. You need to understand this. And you know, there's Freedom of Information Act. There's a whole bunch of other things that enable some of this, but actually systematically, and the government could even put grants into this, you know, so we actually use taxpayer dollars to build up the infrastructure costs, but they wouldn't own it because it's actually the fourth branch of government check and balance that is providing a clear indicator in a way that it can be trusted and I'm not saying these are not magical words. I think we could actually do this, but it is not super easy, that I think could really help slowly step back toward more trust. I'm interested in what you think about this and if you've got
all right ideas. So this is fascinating, and what I would really like to do is, one, do we ask you to sketch it out a little bit, because I get it, this is that local, this is that regional perspective that right now I don't trust a lot of what I'm reading anywhere. So I'd love, in a nutshell, what we're actually talking about. Are these sensors on the light pole and the stop sign, or what does it just look like in a nutshell? And then, Melissa, what I'm going to ask you to do is assure the opponents that are going to say, this is Skynet, Dewey is offering that they're going to take over, to assure that person. But Dewey, just in a few sentences, what are we talking about as far as like the layers of this and the infrastructure?
I can tell you what we've built here. And what we've built here at CSET, the Center for Security and Technology, we publish everything. We have a commitment that we're going to make sure that we're not going to keep the secret report, and we're not working on behalf of someone, and we're just going to bury that. So there's a commitment to making sure it's publicly available. Mm-hmm. That's an extremely important part. Being able to tell what data we used. We're clear about what data we used. We're not like using secret source 14. Mm. Secondly, like in the labor force data, going back to Yolanda, the example, there is a really wonderful way of collecting data locally. You can partner with companies. You know how many people did you lay off today? How many people did you hire? And you can do that in a local level. When you're dealing with it in the local level, you're not trying to. You can actually develop trust with the data providers, and you can actually build up a knowledge of what's actually happening in your state or your county. Mm-hmm. Now you do need a data. So I called it a data trust. Whether that's the perfect term or not, I don't know. But this concept of where you have, you know, in a trust, your trustees have a fiduciary responsibility to the members of that trust to act in their interest. So if you had trustees and, you know, there's legal consequence for a trustee to act outside of the responsibility. And you know, when it happens all the time. And there's ways of dealing with that are well-defined. And this does not require magic. So if you had a concept of a trustee for the state of Maryland or for the state of Oklahoma, and actually they were responsible now, because once again, I lived in Oklahoma. Oklahoma is a super easy state to forget. Exist when you're in and being able to say, this is how we're going to collect this data. We're going to understand where the jobs are. And this is super important data. Like how are we losing jobs? Are people leaving the state? And then you've got a 50 of these data trusts. You've got organizations like CSET, which is what I'm passionate about, why we stood up actually. But and organizations like this are doing analysis, making it publicly available, making sure the data is collected, that we actually need to be able to answer the questions about the powers of levers of power that are actually being operated. Yes, it's not going to be cheap, but I actually think there's many more expensive programs in the existing federal government that already exist that could enable this kind of trust. Data trusts and analytic infrastructure operating in the principles of that fourth branch of government.
I deeply appreciate that insight and the original thinking, because so often when I read and watch, it's arguments that were used 30 and 40 years ago. Well, let's cut taxes. No, we're going to boost social. It's like, okay, maybe there's reason for discussion in all of those areas, but it's not going to solve the bigger problems. Now, as you were talking, and I found so much of that so compelling, the notion of actually knowing from a jobs, education, training, infrastructure, all of the things that we would need to feed the levers. Yet the flip side of it is, Melissa, and I'll go to you on this, I can see people already, and the commercials I'll be seeing when I'm watching The Lincoln Lawyer with my family and or something coming up between, is that just like China, they're moving out and they're going to have AI and you're going to have a social credit score. This is not America. And Dewey Murdoch is the guy leading this, you know, stand up against Dewey if you're for us, something like that. How do we assure people that this is actually can be done in a way that is completely consistent with our values, our constitutional norms.
Well, I mean, to me, this is actually where you do kind of, you invite auditing in, right? That it does need to be independent, that you ensure that every state has an audit that's done. And that audit isn't financial, right? I mean, I love this concept of a trust because it gives you these sort of legal and financial tools that we're accustomed to thinking about. But part of the thing you're auditing is, are you having a negative effect on the people in your state, right? How are you dealing with cybersecurity? How many attacks have you had? How much data have you lost? How many identity theft problems have sprung up because of it? How many complaints have you had about privacy stuff? What mechanisms do you have in place to address bias that you may be baking in? What does diversity, and when I say diversity, I mean, do the people on your trust, the trustees, look like your state? Elite, right? Do you have the skills that you need? I mean, for me, auditing is really, really important. But I also just want to go back to, for me, this has to be an independent organization at the top that brings together insights, but isn't owning and touching all of this raw data. This is not all 50 states dumping all their data into one place, right? If I'm sitting at, and it could even be multiple organizations that are competing to develop insights like CSAT and other organizations who are able and willing to stand up the transparent and rigorous ethical approaches to actually developing that data. It could be all government projects, whether they're grants, contracts, or legislation, have a tax that comes out of that budget that goes to monitoring it. And that money goes out, right? And the effects of that legislation are monitored on every state. But if I'm one of the analysts who are actually drawing from that, I'm not getting raw, de-anonymized data about every citizen where I can look up Yolanda's home phone number, right? Like, and if that happens, then I should go to jail. I mean, it should be, it should be a problem. And I think that, again, you've got to develop this independently of the government. It has to be an independent voice that is, that it may take money from the government. The government may have a seat at the table, but it is not the chairman of the board. And so you have to have people from the press, from the NGO community, from industry at different scales. You have to have people that rotate through a board that looks across this assemblage, right, of trust. And you also have to have that at the state and local level.
And when I think about this, and when we think about folks, let's say in call centers, who know that there is vulnerability going forward, with policy, with the levers, with this kind of insight, back to where we talked about being flat-footed, you wouldn't be as much, because you would have said, whoa, here are all of the cyber trends. Here are, we've seen this many companies have added this automation software. No employees have training. How do we move on that?
And imagine, Eric, if you had this capability, what if you had like a lottery in every state where citizens get to ask up to 15 questions a year that make the analysis cut, right? It's not just rich people and elites from, you know, places like where I've spent my life at Georgetown and MIT and, you know, wherever, Department of Defense, that get to decide what questions get asked, that Yolanda can put her question in, and that there would be a certain amount of analyst time dedicated in each state to actually trying to answer questions that matter there. Great for congressmen to be able to do that. Great for local governments to be able to do that. But maybe citizens should be able to access some of that capability too.
That's exactly where I wanted to go. And Dewey, I'd love to get your thoughts. So do citizens have full access? And I love this idea of you could ask 15, you know, you could make the cut, the lottery, to get 15 questions. But do citizens, do I in, I won't say what town I'm in Virginia, do I in Virginia And I can get on and say, okay, here's what's going on in Fairfax County. Here's what's going on actually over in Maryland. How does that work, Dewey?
Yeah, so a super great idea. And one that we're trying in our little domain at CSET. And I reference CSET not because it's the cat's meow or everything. It just happens to be what I know. So our Emerging Technology Observatory we created is designed to give people access to information that would cost millions of dollars to be able to assemble yourself and allow you as a anybody citizen to play with that and ask your own questions. So I realize this isn't the same thing as job market data, but imagine me being able to come up there and say, well, I'm interested. I'm really quite excited about soft robotics that children can play with, that people can play, that won't hurt them because, you know, robots with big motions and breaking people's bones is terrifying. And it turns out in that research work, there's this whole group of clusters of research that are dealing with soft robotics. And you can explore what are the companies that are working in this space, how much intellectual property filings have been placed in this space. So we've been trying to build these tools for people, for government individuals, for individual citizens. And we keep the data aggregated so we don't violate the licenses. If I was doing job market data or you know job postings or skills or individuals living within a region, we'd have to anonymize it. In fact, we're actually starting a project on this topic. And the goal here is to give people the tools to self answer, ask and answer questions. I think this is super empowering. And especially when, you know, it's unavailable elsewhere. And we're already seeing this. We just did one with all open source software. And you can see software that's useful for zoology questions. I mean, finding that would take you a day to be able to figure out where those open software is and how which one's most used and which one has the most support. We have a dashboard that you can play with. So now going back to Yolanda, saying, okay, I'm really worried. What are the jobs that are in my region? Where are they growing? Where are they shrinking? Are call centers actually starting to fire people? I haven't heard of anyone being fired yet, but I'm curious. I know there's another call center. I don't know anyone there. So you could start to ask these questions to see the trends. You're like, oh, wow, this is really going to go bad. I'm going to need to come up with a plan B. And now you've empowered the Yolandas of the world to make even more informed decisions or to come back to AT&T and with a better proposal of like, okay, I'm seeing this is happening. I've got a better proposal for you. I'd like to suggest we do this.
It also,
you know, go ahead and listen.
It also
please.
Just empowers so much potential innovation. Can you imagine the creative ideas that people would have for small businesses in resources and services that they could provide people if they had access to this data? Like if I could see how all of the job market was changing in my state and I could start to provide targeted training products and experiences for folks that would get them trained to do the closest thing to them that isn't declining, right? If I could actually do some of that deep analysis that I, as an individual person, I don't want to have to learn how to do every single one of these things myself. It takes a lot of skill to sometimes ask the right question of data, right? So when I think about this, I also just think there's such an incredible potential here for innovation around helping people in really concrete ways as well, by opening up this ability to unlock these very opaque trends that are happening around you and empower people. Like, I want people to be able to help me make it easy for me, right?
You know, one of the things I think about so much is as we are getting so complex in our society and things are moving much, much more, we talk about software, coding, automation. A lot of very bright people feel I'm struggling to keep up and participate versus this notion of me too, right? I'm not a software developer. I'm not an engineer by training. But this notion of taming the beast of complexity so that we can actually understand what's going on. Now, I will tell you, it's going to make a lot of family reunions more boring when somebody's out there doing their normal bloviating and you can say, that's not actually true. According to this, the county has been growing in jobs. And by the way, training has moved 3%, or maybe it creates a whole new set of, I don't know. But that could be a separate podcast that we all talk about. Now, what I would, a couple things that I want to bore into here is so interesting. The notion of perception. When we talk about something like this, because I hear you, and I've had the honor over the years of taking family down to Monticello in Virginia, and Thomas Jefferson talked about reinventing this experiment, that it doesn't just say stagnant. So you can't just say, well, this is the way, back to Melissa, what you were saying, well, that's just the way it is, and you're going to have to buck up and figure it out or get out. That things do change. And I think about it, though, I see people interviewed. I'm so worried about the CIA and NSA, and they're getting into my life, yet they're posting their whole life on social media. And you say, there's a little bit of a contradiction here. So from a perception point of view, maybe the CIA, and obviously we have to have serious safeguards, but how we use our data, so critical, but a lot of times maybe to an understanding point, it's not fully understood. So Dewey, and I'd love to get both your thoughts. Dewey, I'll start with you. How do you manage the perceptions on this? Because I think this is such a interesting, valuable idea. How do you manage perceptions?
Yes. So any kind of major change of this type it essentially requires a fairly complex process. And, you know, Athena sprung fully formed from the head of Zeus, and that makes a great story. However, nothing that I've ever met springs fully formed from the head of Zeus. No disrespect to Zeus, but it's just, I've never seen it. I think I was reading Jennifer Balka's book, Recoding America, which I think really gets this point extremely succinctly and clearly. We have to start with simple systems. And she gave examples of like simple forms about getting your COVID test. That was a ridiculously easy form. But that kind of functionality, let's do the very easy things first. Let's slowly build it up and add the complexity, because that's the only way, you know, complex things that work are only there because simple things worked first. And getting to that path. So I think in terms of, you know, perception, because if you go on, you know, the bully pulpit and announce that we are going to solve all transparency issues for the federal government, don't say that. You've got to be very careful. We're going to take a step forward with the labor market within the U.S. It's something that every politician cares about. They know that their likelihood of getting reelected is highly dependent on their local community having jobs. So we start very straightforwardly. We say, this is what we're going to do. We're going to set these expectations. And you slowly build a capability that has trust that you can actually, and it works really well in Oklahoma and Missouri and Illinois. Mm-hmm. And now you're saying, okay, now we're ready to roll it out for another state. It's frustrating in a sense, because I really want this working today. Mm-hmm. But I think you just have to recognize, you have to pick very clear questions. Also, one of the biggest findings that we had from running our organization as a data-driven organization is that it's really expensive to set up a data system that answers everyone's questions. Mm. In fact, it's impossible. And you will drive yourself to bankruptcy immediately. But if you've got two questions to answer, you can do that. You can get that really clearly. And I think that building the perception up on, like, let's pick the two most important questions and go there. And then we'll add a third question and we'll add a fourth question. And then we'll eventually get to the point where we can say, you know, you can ask questions of this type, or this type, and then we can slowly expand it. In this fourth estate concept, it's an organically grown capability that builds checks and balances, and it has to build trust. If it doesn't build trust, then we have just wasted all our time. And it has to be built in a way that's painfully transparent and very, very, you know, red state, blue state, Purple State need to be able to see the value of this, and they need to be able to believe that you're not going to just try to get DeSantis out of Florida with this data. And that's, I'm saying, as if I, or whatever.
No, I get it. It's not going to be politically weaponized.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not saying that there isn't political consequences from this data. In fact, it has to have political consequences, but it needs to be built in a way that brings that trust. And I think this is what America needs. We need to believe. I mean, democracy is gorgeous. It's beautiful to have empowered, to be empowered. And right now we live in a world that's sad because we don't feel empowered. We feel disempowered. We feel like everything's happening to us. And I feel like this is our top priority as a citizen of the United States to figure out how we can make sure we don't go off the authoritarian cliff, because there's forces that could drive us straight off that puppy. And I think that is terrifying to me.
Melissa,
I feel so strongly in agreement with Dewey, and I'll harken back to an earlier podcast with you, my sort of war on efficiency, Eric. I think that somewhere along the way, we all became so obsessed with efficiency and driving everything to be hyper efficient and cheap that what we essentially did was drive human connection out of everything. Right? And at the end of the day, trust is high touch. Trust isn't efficient. But guess what? A lack of trust is way more expensive. And at the end of the day, we've got to put people back into this conversation. You've got to have town hall meetings. You have to listen to people be scared and complain, right? You have to make government more real and accessible to them. It's incredible to me that we believe that we can take the brightest minds and strip mine them from small towns all across America, move them to coasts with college degrees, people like me, right? To have careers, and then wonder why those communities don't trust us. I mean, the connections back to those communities are gone. The people who normally who would have stayed and driven development in those communities are often gone. So bringing back this connection and this dialogue and sitting with people and allowing them to have concerns and also prioritizing some of their questions, right? Not deciding the most important questions from on high, but working in a collaborative, co-creative state to decide these are the two most important questions to solve, not just because they're the ones that the Department of Defense would most like to have access to, or Congress would most like to have access to, but because at least one of them is most likely to help rebuild trust. And I do think that this idea of co-creation, again, just brings us back to kind of where we started. The human in concert with technology is a much more powerful force than sort of pitting these against one another and driving us into a place where technology takes over everything. Humans get taxed into oblivion and feel completely disempowered and angry. Like, the czars were killed in the streets for a reason. Let's just not wind up there. Let's just know better.
You know, I could talk to both of you for hours just on this subject alone, and then perhaps say, hey, let's do another podcast on some other ideas here. But what I might offer just in a quick wrap up, and I love how you both have brought it back into very concrete applications. So people can say, I'm part of this and I see how that idea could help. If we were to say to Yolanda or my friend Bill or anybody else, we'd say, all right, well, what's an example, a legislative example perhaps, that represents maybe some of this thinking, maybe not all of it, but even just a bit of moving in the right direction. Dewey, is there anywhere where we could look and say, here's a little bit of optimism. Here's something we've done a bit differently legislatively. Is anything come to mind?
So unfortunately, the first thing that comes to mind is what I've been obsessed with my most of my life in trying to create information in a form that people can actually use for decision making. Mm-hmm. So CSET is an example of an organization that has produced a lot of content that people can actually use to inform how immigration is actually happening in the U.S. Mm-hmm. For technical spaces, can help inform where the technology choke points that we're vulnerable as a nation to from other countries. And when you create that, our actions become much clearer. So mm-hmm. we've seen in response to this kind of analysis, actions that, you know, the CHIPS and Science Act, which we haven't gotten into, we don't have time to go into all the details, is an example of a response that is consistent with our analysis. And we've kind of laid out how the government can work. So I'm basically laying out, rather than the answer of a specific bill that I'm super excited about, because once again, that's almost an anathema to what we're trying to talk about. A single bill will not solve the problem. Mm. It has to be our thinking that has to be holistic. And so yeah. I think this template of like actually have evidence, be able to say that this is options we have. Here's the class of actions that would help with high-skilled immigration versus, you know, opening versus closing, helping to bring innovation back to the U.S. that's left quite a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some bills out there which have been recently introduced in the House and Senate that have basically said this type of role that CSET is playing is one that we need to be part of our regular decision-making construct. And I'm very excited about that. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have no idea if it'll pass, but and even if it passes, it's a small part and there's all the other issues we talked about. So I'm very hopeful because I believe we can protect people's privacy. We can provide information to inform people's actual decisions. And I have a ton of hope. It's not going to be easy. And I do believe even partisan players that I talk mm-hmm. to recognize, you know, they might not agree about anything, but they tend to agree about this, mm-hmm. that we really need to make informed policymaking. And we need to adjust, especially when we're in competition with a peer innovator like China. That also is a motivator for some of these discussions.
Mm, absolutely. Melissa?
I don't know. I hate to end this on a less positive note, but I'm honestly less, I see less than Dewey does, right? I see a lot of people willing to use these tools to make an initial decision and start something. Mm-hmm. I see almost no progress towards a feedback loop that will stop bad things once you've started them. Mm-hmm. And this to me is why I am 100% in on it's time for an independent voice. It's time for a new fourth estate. It's time for a new check and balance. And to me, there's not progress towards this, but there is a desire for it that I think we haven't seen before in the United States. I think there is a hunger for a re-engagement. There's a hunger for being respected and for being viewed as something more than just a coal mine of humans, right? Mm-hmm. And so for me, my optimism largely comes from the fact that I think people are ready to demand something better than we're being given. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I think Congress and the federal government are working within a post-World War II construct that they are unable and unwilling to let go of. They're trying very hard, but they don't know how to do it inside the system. And that's why I think for the sake of the federal government, this needs to be done somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. I will tell you that in talking with both of you, this is one of the most fascinating podcasts that I've ever done, and it has reinvigorated my, let's say, focus and passion on these topics because I can get incredibly frustrated. I see a lot of, let's say, old frameworks to what you're talking about, Melissa. I see a lot of just poor behavior, poor civil discourse. And I get frustrated. And I've noticed amongst friends and family that there is a negativity with all of it. And yet part of me says this should be such an exciting time. We have so many incredible things coming online. Let's not be afraid of it. Let's work to understand it. Let's, as the Marines say, let's improvise, adapt, overcome, or maybe not overcome, but you get my point. So the final question, and I'm serious, I'd love to do another podcast. We could pick another area to go into because today we really just did automation. But the two of you have been at these things for decades. And each time I talk to you, there is a passion for continuing to stay in the fight. Dewey, my last question to you, and I'll go to Melissa. What fuels that passion? When somebody says, what's your why, what would you tell them?
Well, I guess I go back to, I really believe in humanity. I believe that a connected group of people who are working in the interest of more than just themselves is a beautiful capability, an organism. And this is, in our society, what a people do in a country, in a state, in a region. It's made up of lots of other communities that all have, and we're wiser together. And so when anything that I can do to help people make better decisions, to think about things in a different perspective, it's what gets me up every morning. I spring out of bed, like, I know what I'm going to do today. Mm-hmm. And I've been this way almost my entire career because I've been in this business of helping people, collections of people, make better decisions. And it's powerful. I mean, it's the most important job. I'm not important myself, but it's the most important job that I can imagine myself dedicating my energy to.
And Dewey, just one more time, the website, because I want new folks coming to that website and I want them to see some of the studies and the tools. That website again, please.
Yeah, cset.georgetown.edu. That's what we put everything there. And we set it as to kind of be a beacon on the hill that people could see and copy from and figure out how to do something like it and maybe better than what we do.
Awesome. Really appreciate it. Melissa, what stokes that passion? And whether you're waging a war on efficiency, whether you're really giving us your insight on AI and autonomy, what keeps you in that fight?
I have been so incredibly lucky. I've had so many people who went before me who paused and reached a hand back and gave me space, supported me, allowed me to have sharp elbows and a loud voice and tolerated all of the insanity, and really empowered me to be better, to use my talents in service of something way bigger than myself. And I feel responsible for doing the same for other people. And I feel so empowered and excited when I talk to young people and I see how much they care. And I learn so much from that interaction. And I cannot imagine being the person that wants to extract from them. I don't want to be a part of making their future less than my future was. I want to be responsible to the people who come behind me the way that I feel the people ahead of me have been responsible to me.
I really appreciate both of you coming on. I had high hopes for this podcast discussion, conversation, and both of you have exceeded those hopes. So thank you both so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was a fun conversation.
You bet. And folks, in wrap up out there, the couple things that I just want you to really think about. One, get on that CSET site. I've been on it. I'm going to go back on it after that. Secondly, send us questions. We will, behind the scenes, we'll reach out to Melissa or Dewey. If you have questions on any of this, there are so many thought-provoking ideas that we covered today. Please hit us up with questions. And the last thing I'll say is keep engaging. Engagement is what makes this great experiment work. We've all got to stay active. And frankly, now we're armed with a lot more arrows in the quiver of things to be engaging about at all levels. So everybody, thanks so much. And GovCon Different will be coming at you soon with new topics, but really appreciate you listening.
GovCon Different, ideas from the outside applied to GovCon to drive change.